Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 436. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are John Lindemann.
I just want everybody to know that out of respect for this podcast, I am wearing a suit today. You can't see it, but I'm wearing it.
That's a dig on James Jones.
Well, what you couldn't see is that I was also wearing shorts during that, so I was all kinds of appropriate for the situation. Thank you, John Lindemann.
That's a great mental image to have now. Guillaume is on vacation this week, and so taking his place, we have a dear old friend coming back for the first time in a very long while. It's Dan Bloodworth.
Hey, good to be here.
I don't know how many of our listeners have been around since the double-digit days back in, or as I called it, the Jurassic era of this podcast, where I can't actually remember most of the episodes from back then. It's been so long ago. But you were on the podcast a few times back in the old days of Evan and Mike and Carl and Stan and me sometimes. But you know, mostly before I was hosting. And actually, this might be the first time you've ever been on when I was actually the host of the show. So it's been like it's been 7 or 8 years. Let's put it that way. It's been a very long time. Great to have you back. Dan is like one of the shining examples of one of the people from our website, Planet GameCube at the time, going pro and becoming a professional game journalist, for lack of a better term. I don't know. What do you consider yourself, Dan? What's your job?
It doesn't make any sense anymore. I mean, it's I think that game journalist is definitely the easy shorthand, especially when you talk about just the industry in general. But there are definitely other people that I work with that are like die hard. No, we are not journalists, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. But Dan is well known for his years of great work over at GameTrailers.com. And, you know, kind of started out as like a behind the scenes video producer. And over the years, got more and more, you know, kind of out there in podcasts and the videos and all the live stuff that they're doing nowadays. And it's great to have you back, Dan. I've been trying for years to get you on the podcast, and I'm really excited that we finally did it. So let's kick it off. We're going to have a bunch of great games to talk about here in a few minutes on New Business. And coming up later, we're going to do a Thunder Round edition of Listener Mail with lots of quick, short questions and answers. It's going to be a lot of fun, very excited. And we're going to talk about Retroactive. I guess we should announce Retroactive right up front, James.
Yeah, so the grand scheme of, well, there's no way Nintendo will do something weird and swerve on us by just pegging this to their next virtual console game. We got swerved on, and they went and picked Blaster Master for the NES, now released on its 75th Nintendo platform.
Amazingly, a great game.
You can play this now on possibly everything Nintendo has ever released.
Really?
This is the fourth virtual console release for this game, which maybe we shouldn't be super surprised if you want to play it on your third.
How does that work? Fourth?
It's the third virtual console release.
The third, okay. Yeah. It is on 3DS, and it was on the original Wii, which means you can upgrade it for 50 cents if you bought it. I think it's 50 cents
on
NES, isn't it?
I'm reading the press release.
Oh, okay.
It's a dollar.
I'll believe you.
So,
but a dollar.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do so for Retroactive.
There you go. I mean, or if you're just cheap, you can go buy it.
You better appreciate it, people.
That's right.
$1.
So I'm thinking we'll probably do this one, not next week, obviously, but maybe the week after. It's going to be a much shorter Retroactive. We'll post up the thread. I'll probably post it tonight, so it'll definitely be up by the time this article goes, or this episode goes live. And we'll include a link in the article. Like I said, probably aiming for the week of, so we'll be recording it on the 30th of July. But like I said, that may be subject to change. We'll see. We'll have a better idea next week.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. And of course, we really hope that everybody who listens to the show will play along with us and you know, post in the forum thread and participate with us over the social media and everything. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Blaster Master is a game that everybody should feel good about buying. If you've never played it before, it's an easy game to jump into, and I think you'll get why it's fun right off the bat. And it's a game where in my experience, having save states in this game makes it a little bit easier and more fun. Made it a better experience for me compared to my old memories of it. So I think it's a fantastic stroke of luck. And best of all, it's kind of a troll on James because he was hoping we'd get a terrible game.
I wasn't hoping. I was anticipating.
You were secretly hoping.
I think you were secretly hoping.
I mean, look, if we had
gotten... You seem a little perturbed at just how this turned out, James. Whereas I'm like, hey, thankfully, I don't have to play a bad game.
If
I'm
we're
so
going
to
go... If they're going to put a swerve on us, I want it to be something that's memorable. So if they're going to swerve on us, I want it to be China Warrior. I'm sorry. I just do. we've called
so many...
That's
what he truly wanted in his heart of
hearts. We've called so many
games
China Warrior insultingly. It's time we actually have to deal with the real fucking thing.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, going back to when I first started at Game Trailers, like, just getting virtual console footage was just a routine. Like, I was meant to do that every single week, and just, you know, because at the time, that, like, actually made a big difference. People were looking for that stuff and watching that. And so, pretty much, I'd say 90% of the virtual console games that came out on the original Wii, we've purchased, and I've played at least 5 or 10 minutes of.
Yep. Yep. We got a true virtual console expert here.
That's a lot of amazing, amazing, we'll call it that, games.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, that was a real service to the consumer base back then, because the Nintendo Wii shop channel did not have videos for the games.
It was barely anything.
It was basically like a really crude web page that just had a couple of screenshots and some like really basic information about it and a price. It was all very slow. So, you know, taking that footage and putting it up, I mean, they're trying to sell these old games to a lot of younger people or less, you know, less experienced, less hardcore gamers who maybe didn't know what these games were about and they needed to go online to do their research because Nintendo didn't really offer the tools to make good decisions on the shop channel. So having game trailers around for stuff, I used it for sure back then.
Yes, if you're trying to decide if you should buy Cybernoid for the Commodore 64 on the Wii Virtual Console,
you
have Dan to thank for making it clear you should not buy Cybernoid.
Or honestly, and Dan, I've used your videos for this purpose. I'd be like, I'd read the description in that press release or the article up on the site, and I'd say, that sounds like a game I've played, but I know what it looks like, and it's hard to tell sometimes with the stuff from the 80s and the early 90s. And so I would go to your site and watch those videos to confirm that, oh yeah, this is the game I'm thinking of. I definitely don't ever want to play that again. You know, like Dino Wars with a Z.
Right.
The true sign of quality.
Anything with a Z is better.
So before we get into the meat of the segment and talk about a bunch of different games, I wanted to spend a few minutes on Mr. Iwata. Because as people on our social media accounts will know, that news came out just a couple hours before we published the last episode. And so we didn't have a chance to weigh in on it. By the time you hear this show, it'll have been more than a week. And, you know, I think you'll have already heard a lot of people talking about it and have read a lot about it. And you know, we're not going to have anything that fresh to add to the conversation. But I just thought it'd be nice to spend a few minutes acknowledging his legacy and the influence he's had on our lives and, you know, on the games that we play and on this, you know, huge industry of video games and just share a few happy memories of him, you know, things that stick out to you the most or whatever, but just for a few minutes and then we'll move on to things that are more uproariously, wonderfully fun and happy. But Mr. Iwata was a really fun guy, and I guess I'll go first. I might have told this story before, so I'll try to make this brief, but I remember seeing Mr. Iwata on the eve of him being announced as the president of Nintendo and the CEO. I had seen him once before, I think at E3 2001. I had probably seen him at a press conference and maybe even in an interview. Or maybe one of the other people on the staff had interviewed him for some GameCube game that he was working on, you know, Smash Brothers or something. So anyway, I knew who he was. I'd seen him around, but I'd never met him or anything. I saw him that evening at the Nintendo party, you know, which was very glitzy. There were lots of, you know, famous to me people, you know, like, you know, famous Nintendo people. You'd see Miyamoto over there in the corner and you wouldn't want to go bother him because he had all his friends and they were drunk. But, it, you know, it was, like, really cool just to, like, walk through this maze of video game people and feel like, oh, God, what am I doing here? And I saw Iwata there, and he had been at the press conference and had spoken in English at the, you know, at the press conference. And it sounded very kind of stodgy and rehearsed. And I thought, well, I wonder if he's really that good of an English speaker, or if he just like really kind of practiced this one very, very strict speech, you know, and stayed on it. And it sounded kind of awkward to me. And then that party that night, I saw him just casually like drinking a beer, leaned up against the wall, talking to an American guy in English about baseball or something like that. And I thought, wow, he really is like very fluent and like, you know, really cool and personable. And I think the guy he was talking to was not even a Nintendo employee, which is weird because at those parties they would always kind of cloister together. I remember being very impressed by it and thinking, huh, you know. And then the very next morning he was announced to be the new president, and it immediately struck me that, you know, I had just seen him the night before in Los Angeles, and now he's the president of the company, and how incredibly different that was from Yamauchi, who had, you know, been running the company for like 60 years and had never stepped foot in America, even though he owned a fortune, you know, in this country. So I just thought, and Yamauchi didn't speak English at all and had no interest in it, and he didn't get on planes. And, you know, I just thought, man, what an incredible sea change this is for the company. It's so exciting for them to have a fresh face and for him to be so completely different from what you saw before. And I remember being really excited by that. And, over the years, I often questioned his decisions and the way he ran the company. But I think there's no doubt that in the end he'll be seen as a very positive force on the company's history, and a really important person in the history of video games. And so that's my happy memory of Mr. Iwata.
I mean, it was very weird seeing this. Just the way I found out about it was on Twitter. Caught me completely flat-footed because there was really no run-up to it. There was no, oh, he's in the hospital. There was no Steve Jobs kind of thing where, you know, press reports where you knew he had cancer. He was looking very sickly. I mean, obviously he had lost weight, but there was nothing. I mean, this came completely out of nowhere. Didn't expect it. Didn't even believe it really when I saw the tweet. It just, what I remember thinking was those words don't look like they belong together, right?
Right.
Like Satoru Iwata passes away at 55. I was like, what? I couldn't even comprehend really what, like, it was just really weird. But yeah, I mean, really, when I think of him, it was interesting because James actually, I don't know if I'm stealing James's thunder here, but he linked Game Center CX, right?
Yeah.
The Japanese show where he linked very, very, it was very interesting. They had him on that show with the chief. And he kind of did an interview. He sort of interviewed the chief, which was interesting. He was supposed to be the one being interviewed, but first off, he was the one that was actually interviewing the chief more so than the chief interviewing him. But one of the funniest things that he said, and I think it's very Iwata, is the chief asked him, he was talking about how he got started in the games industry, and he said, well, you know, I mean, he started actually to program games on a, on like a, you know, just a
text-only calculator.
Yes. Yeah. Like one of those, the programmable ones. And he said that he just started doing it first off. I mean, you know, he just did it completely on his own. And he actually wound up going to Nintendo, and he told them that he thought he could make games for them. Nobody asked him to. He just said, yeah, I can do this. Can I do it? But the funniest thing, though, was when the chief asked him, he's like, you know, because in Japan it's a very big deal, like, you know, what your family thinks about your career, whether they approve or disapprove. And he said, well, yeah, like he said, you know, your dad must not have approved of that at all. He said, well, no, I hated it. He absolutely hated it. And he said, well, you know, did you ever think of giving up in the game industry, like getting some other job that, you know, your dad approved of? And he said, no, absolutely not. He said, I knew what I wanted to do. And he said that as far as I was concerned, I knew where that computers were becoming the biggest thing, and that's what I wanted to do, and that's where I saw everything going. So he said, I didn't care what my dad thought at all. He just went and did it. And that's pretty much how he ran Nintendo. Even though people, you know, constantly questioned what he did, you know, often didn't believe in the products that he released, he just had this conviction, and that's how he ran the company. And that's kind of how I'll always think of him, is that he didn't really care what you thought of what he was doing. He always had his own very firm convictions on the way the game industry was going, and oftentimes he was right. And you know, you may be able to argue with the results, but even when he failed, I think, you know, certain products that didn't do very well, there was always a grain of, You know, Iwata was right in a certain way. Maybe he didn't nail it in the execution of the product, but he was, you know, especially with, you know, like you know, games becoming very, very costly to make with HD and stuff like that. He was very right in a lot of ways, and it's, you know, there's a lot of good stuff that has kind of glossed over the bad stuff that has gone on with that part of the industry. But yeah, I mean, very intelligent guy. You know, certainly, you know, I think people, you know, loved Iwata because he was a genuine guy. You know, he wasn't one of these corporate suits that gets trotted out there. He was a programmer. That's why he got so much respect that he did, really. But, and he was also very humble.
And he had a real personality. You know, he didn't sound super rehearsed and corny like a lot of these other people you see at press conferences.
Exactly. Just very, very genuine.
He seemed to know it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a self-awareness and a humility and, you know, a quirkiness. And there's definitely a lot of winking and what he was doing and a vulnerability, you know. Like, we as Americans, I think, probably see him differently than Japanese people do. But, you know, we see him speaking to us in our own language. And to me, I always felt, I felt kind of like honored that, honored's a weird word, but I felt that, you know, the fact that he was willing to come over here and speak to us in our own language at some considerable effort on his part, I'm sure. I think it says a lot about, you know, how much he cared and how much he was personally invested in it. And what you saw is that he was much more visible and infused his own personality, his own interests, his own ideas for the company in a much more public way than Mr. Yamauchi did, who was, you know, Yamauchi's fairly reclusive, doesn't really give interviews. Iwata does his own interviews. Like to me, he's like the Nintendo president who kind of wanted to be a video game journalist and like found like weird ways to keep sort of inserting himself into the role that usually would be played by the independent media and eventually sort of leading this institutionalized version of video game journalism within Nintendo that's essentially their marketing department now, you know, where they're producing the kinds of content that 10 years ago we were doing and they weren't. So, he had an interesting relationship with the media and I think a lot of it was just came down to his personal kind of enthusiasm for talking to developers and getting those stories out there and talking directly to consumers as well.
Especially because when he did those interviews, they always seemed to be leading. Like, he knew, like, there were, I went back and read a bunch of them in prepping for this Nintendo news report we did earlier this week.
Yeah, which people should check out, by the way. You can see James in a suit.
I wore a suit. There are a couple where you can see that maybe a game, that maybe he had a disagreement with the development staff on a game in development. And like there's one, I'm trying to remember what game it was for, but he basically, I told you so to the developers during this thing. And you get the everybody laughs parenthetical note in there, but I'm guessing the only person who was laughing happily was him and everybody else is going like,
definitely from the interview, with Chief, I got the idea just, his presence was such that you get the idea that he kind of has this kind of cute and cuddly persona, but you really get the idea that you wouldn't really want to cross the guy. I just kind of got that idea, like, because
I think that also comes out of Japanese corporate culture where, you know, you're like very subservient to your boss, you know, and you really have to respect them and do exactly as they say, and that's kind of the respect that's institutionalized.
He does put up a little bit of a harder edge to his wit in that particular video. He's explaining how the fish works in that game. You know, how you can't see it underwater, it's going back and forth. So if you get down to the water and the fish isn't there, you survive, and if it is there, you get eaten.
Yeah, it's in a balloon fight. That's what they play. The game that they play is, which he programmed, which is hysterical.
Yeah, Arno's like, you know, going, I don't know about that, and he just sharply responds, I know, I programmed it.
It's a great interview.
Like, he just mic drops right there, and you're just like, damn!
I'm gonna have to watch this now.
Oh, you gotta watch it. It's only 15 minutes long, so go watch it. Find it and watch it. It's totally worthwhile.
Oh, it is a beautiful mic drop, too.
Yeah, that's a good way to remember Iwata. Dan, how are you remembering Mr. Iwata this week?
Yeah, it's weird because like I've been through a lot of these on different shows, but I definitely love Iwata Asks, like just the whole series. You know, I don't have a specific story to tell from them, but it's just that fact that like he would get in there with them and dig out all of this weird stuff. And you know, and again, like from those days where I was just like trying to find any kind of video of a game, those would have these clips of things that you would never see. Like, you would never put that out in the open. Like, another company, you know, they wouldn't show that.
Well, they're showing, like, the Minus World and Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, you know, that could be one example. But, you know, just, like, lots of just, like, weird little quirky things or stuff that was, you know, not from the final game, but something that, like, was in development that didn't work out. And just, like, getting in there and, like, really, you know, making those developer conversations feel real and authentic, which you didn't really, you know, a lot of people, you know, put out developer diaries as part of their marketing campaign, and they just fall flat because they're not saying anything, you know, they're not telling you any insight to why they did this or that. They're just going over the same bullet points that are in every other piece.
Yeah, it's the kind of summary that you might have someone do even just for internal use, just to have a record of how development went. I don't know. I've heard so much praise for Iwata Asks over the past week. I never read them a ton. You know, I'd read one every now and then when someone pointed at it. But, you know, part of it is that they tend to be pretty long. And
yeah.
And my free time to just read stuff like that just out of personal interest has really gone down over the years. And, you know, it's been striking because I do think he's a very good interviewer. Obviously, he has, you know, privileged knowledge of how these games are made and who the people are and what roles they played and, you know, what that environment is like. And he's able to ask these really specialized questions that like no video game journalist could really do unless you were like embedded, which, you know, carries a lot of other weird conflicts. But yeah, I've heard, you know, like, you know, no one interviews like him. And I think that's true, but also like he had access to interview people that really no one else does. You know, that was one thing that always struck me is that some of the most interesting interviews that he would do with like sound people or hardware people,
yeah,
that Nintendo never lets the media get at. And so we don't hear their stories. It's not because we're not trying, but you know, it just Nintendo just shuts that stuff down. And you can tell that he was really interested in these different aspects of video games because he would, you know, I think it was probably his idea to go that deep into the company and talk to these people who don't normally get their stories told.
Yeah. I remember the Wii U Iwata Asks when they were just going through and they were talking about the gamepad and how much weight was in there. It's like, well, what else can we add to it? And then, well, how much does it weigh? You know, like just these tiny little things that make a difference that you wouldn't normally think about. But yeah, I know what you're saying. It's like, I feel like those kinds of interviews don't come up anymore. I remember.
I was always so jealous of Iwata.
Yeah. I remember back in the day, I did talk to those guys about Game Boy Player. You know, I got like that really in-depth interview with them about that.
I was there with you on that one because I remember it very, very distinctly.
Since then, yeah, I rarely have come up. I mean, this year Nintendo didn't even really do anything like that. You know, it's like, okay, you can come get direct feed of some Wii U games, and that was about it.
Yeah, the interviews were few and far between, as they have been for many years. But you know, there was a lot of filling in the holes, doing a bunch of his own, and yeah, I think a lot of people will remember that. I've heard people talk about, you know, wishing that it would just, I think it was on Player One podcast, they mentioned like just publishing all of them in a book. Mm. And I think that'd be really cool.
Audiobook would be great too, because you're talking about reading, yeah.
That would be good. Or even just as a text dump in some like really bare bones like Wii U app, you could just, if they could offer it on the eShop for, I don't know, $1 or whatever, you know. That'd be really cool. But anyway, Dan, what have you been playing? Let's do some new business for real. Let's perk it up a little bit.
We did, in relation to Iwata, we did stream about an hour of Kirby's Adventure the other night, which, oddly enough, I don't know if I had ever played that much of that game before. I played a lot of Kirby games all the way through, but there was stuff in there that I didn't remember. I didn't realize how many powers were there that early on.
Yeah, it's the true prototype game of the series.
Yeah,
you know, like the one, you know, the Dreamland on Game Boy is like, it's almost like a weird, it's like 2D Wolfenstein, You know, like it exists, but it doesn't really have that much to do with what it's what the series is really known for.
Yeah. And just like some of the environments, how those kept changing up. There are these crazy airships in there that I didn't, you know, I didn't remember. The one thing that I really, really liked, it had this, when you first start the game and you have to do like from a hard boot or you have to wait for it, they have this funny thing where they're like drawing the shape of Kirby. And it's like, this is the body and here are the eyes and then you add the arms. Just that to me felt like a very Iwata style thing.
He's probably the one who did it.
Yeah. Oh man. I've been working my way through my second playthrough of The Witcher 3. I did the review for Game Trailers, but it was on a PS4 debug. So I can't hang on to that save file. It's not going to do me any good. It doesn't connect to the internet or anything for patches. So in order to, in order to be able to do the expansions when they come out, and then just for my own personal reasons, since, you know, I've got this PC and I had the save files from the old games. You know, I'm doing my second playthrough of Witcher 3 on the PC now.
And that game must have been a glitchy mess on the PS4 debug.
It had some issues for sure. It's been amazing to see how week after week it continues to improve. They're about to release the 7th patch now. but they just continue to do things. And one of the funny things is some of the stuff that they've announced for the next patch are things that I asked for before release. It's like, all right, you're doing it. Let's do this. Put books in another tab.
Emergent gameplay right there.
I'm sort of waiting for all that stuff to get implemented and for everybody to be like, yeah, at this point, it's a fully functional, properly working, good-feeling game. But I'm super interested in it, too. And John and I made a pact. I did play a couple hours of GTA 5, so...
Good.
I'm making baby steps towards the goal, but yeah, when I finish that and when he finishes, Fallout 3 or Skyrim that you were playing? Skyrim.
Yeah.
Right? Skyrim.
Oh man, yeah. I gotta go back to Skyrim. Damn. Yeah.
You got 2015.
Start putting it on your calendar because you're gonna have that game is work. I mean, it's a lot of fun, but it's some serious time to put into that game.
Yeah, Witcher 3 is interesting, and it's a very hard game to discuss with anyone who hasn't beaten it because it is a game that like builds on itself very well in layers, and so you definitely do get the points where you feel like, okay, I've seen everything, I know how this is going to go, it's just going to be more of the same, and then you get to like another act more or less. They're not really broken up that way, but then it feels like it shifts tone and you get into a whole lot of other things, and then it all really comes together very well in the last act, and just the investment that you've made into all the characters and stuff by that point really makes a difference into how you perceive that game overall.
Dan, I know you're a big Zelda fan. Has it given you any ideas or any like extra tinge of excitement for the new Zelda for Wii U? I mean, the world seems a little like just even visually it seems a little bit similar. This big open world that's kind of this fantasy. You know, green forests and big mountains and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think I definitely scratched that itch in a way of being sort of, in some ways, a more mature Zelda game. And others, you know, of course it's not because it doesn't have, like, you know, the tools and the puzzles in that sense. There are a couple of minor puzzles here and there. But one of the things, you know, we were talking a little while ago about was sort of, like, if you're going to compare it to, you know, the other big RPG from the first half of this year is Bloodborne. And in a way, it's like their designs are really different in terms of the world, because Bloodborne is like, this world is perfectly crafted for you to explore and discover and just like be like just amazed at like the way the levels come back on themselves and the shortcuts and things that you find. Whereas The Witcher 3, also has an amazing world, but it's a world that's built like you're not, like it's not made for you. It's made in spite of you. You know, it's like, this is a world that feels like you're actually in a real place that makes sense. And, you know, on the outskirts of the city, there are guys, you know, making bricks and dyeing wool. And I came across in my second playthrough, I put 160 hours in this game and I'm still coming across things I haven't seen before. And I found these guys that were just like, they're more or less like the bums that like pull stuff out of the recycle bins, because they're just selling bottles. They're just guys on the shore and they're selling bottles. And like, why would I ever need to buy bottles? But you guys are here. Okay. You
know, it's just... Yeah, that's really Skyrim-ish. Like, why is this guy even in the game?
But what it does better than Skyrim, and I think most open world games, is it really gives meaning to a lot more of that stuff, so that if you're doing a quest and it's not that important, it'll be really short. You know, you might make a couple of decisions here and there and it's done in 5 minutes. If you do anything that's lengthy, it has, you know, a story and a background to it, and it all feels like it was worth doing, which kind of flies in the face of a lot of the, you know, the kind of radio tower design that we've seen in open world games.
Yeah, GTA definitely has some issues with missions being way too long for how much actually happens. And part of it is that a lot of the actual missions in GTA 5, and this is true of all of them really, going back to 3 at least, is that a lot of the missions are primarily driving. And you also have to drive to get to the mission. So a lot of times a session of GTA 5 will be, I'll sit down, I'll pick out an icon on the map and say, okay, I need to get over there. But it takes 5 or 10 minutes of driving to get over to that point, because, you know, I don't just have jet fighters all over the place that I can hop into. So by the time I get over there, I've already been driving for a while. And then I watch a 30-second cutscene for the start of the mission, and then most of the mission is just driving for another 10 or 15 minutes while these people chat. Mm. And it's like, you know, I like the driving in GTA 5, but sometimes it feels like that's 80% of the game.
Yeah, now I think in GTA 5 they do a good job by always making it entertaining hearing these people go back and forth, but
yeah,
you're still just sitting there flying through the air in a helicopter.
I feel like I'm just kind of a taxi driver most of the time. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, this stuff with The Witcher sounds way more gratifying. You know, it's like if you're going to play a 30-minute long mission where you have to go through all these different steps and everything, it's going to be something with enough story that you feel invested in it and that you really care about what happens. And if it's just some kind of like, you know, little thing, you know, just to teach you how to do a certain mechanic or just a whatever, you know, let you explore this little corner of the world, it's like just a 5-minute chore or just a little quick activity. That sounds way better. But anyway, for now, we'll move on to what John's been playing. I'm excited for this one.
Yeah, well, I finally bit on Splatoon. So I picked that up, and I'm enjoying it so far. I'm enjoying it a lot. I have to say, the core gameplay of Splatoon is really, really good. My first impression of the game is that it's kind of like junk food. It doesn't really take you anywhere, but it's so easy with Splatoon to just kind of sit there and just play, and just play again, and just play over again. And the next thing you know, 2 hours have gone by, and you've just really sat there and not done a whole lot except play Splatoon. So, yeah, it's just, it's really, really good. The only thing I would criticize at this point is there really does need to be, needs to be fleshed out a bit. That's what I would like to see in a sequel. You know, more maps, stuff like that. But it's not really a big deal. And I think the smartest thing that they did with Splatoon is the fact that the matches are so short. It really gets them off the hook for a lot of stuff that would normally be annoying. Because, you know, there's not many maps, you know, so, and you're only usually playing two maps at a time anyways. But the matches are so short it really doesn't matter. You know, just a lot of stuff like that. They've taken away a lot of the stuff that you would normally get tired of in shooters. You know, if you're playing a team and you're incredibly overmatched, it doesn't really matter because the match is going to be over soon anyways. So I thought that was really, really brilliant, the way that they did that. And it was something that I wouldn't have anticipated coming into the game. The fact that the matches are so short that they're not, the stakes aren't very high. In other words, you know, if things aren't going the way that you necessarily want them to go, or it's not a map that you like to play on, doesn't really matter because, you know, next thing you know, it's over. And also, the fact that the matches are so short lets you kind of turn the tables at the very end, which is really, really fun because you can actually, if you kind of work things out, like if you kill a bunch of the other players at the same time near the end of a match, they're taken all the way back to their spawn point And at that point, you can, if it's a close match, you can turn the tide by just taking over large swaths of territory. Hmm. So it's really clever. I mean, I like it. I think they've done a really, really good job of it.
What level are you at?
Right now, I think I'm at level, I haven't really played it in a little while, but I'm at about level 11.
Yeah, you're already ahead of me, dude, and I've owned it for a month.
So you've just now gotten to ranked battles then?
Yeah, I got to ranked. Now, is ranked only Splat Zone?
Splat Zone, and they just added the tower thing, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's specific matches. But yeah, I mean, Splat Zone was fun. It's just the thing is, the core, it doesn't really matter what type of, like, I'm not really too hung up on types of matches, because the gameplay experience is relatively the same, and just, and that core feeling of just covering stuff with paint is so satisfying that the objective is, it almost, it's, I don't really care. It's kind of secondary, you know, and it really feels good to, you know, to be able to dip down into the paint, come up behind somebody and take them out. And you can do some pretty advanced stuff. I mean, you can, that kind of quick stealth mode that you can slip into.
Yeah.
You know, you can pop up behind people and you can take like three people out at once if you time it right. And if you, because you can watch other players and you can see, hey, this guy has no idea that I'm even here. Hmm. Even though he's not that far away from you, you can tell. It's good. It's good. I'm enjoying it.
So Splatoon gets the serious gamer approval.
Yeah, it definitely gets the thumbs up. It does get a bit repetitive. They really, really need to tweak the UI and do some things. I mean, Callie and Marie, I don't need. The thing is, what's funny about it to me is that they have so few maps, but yet they insist on telling you about them every single time you log into the game. That they need to checkbox that stuff out of there and just say, I don't want to see this stuff again.
They could at least make that thing about twice as fast. And it would, you'd still get all the pertinent information.
Yeah, they just need, I wish that they would just allow you to just check a checkbox so you wouldn't even see it. Because I don't really care what maps I'm playing. I don't really care, you know? And I mean, and after you've played them all a number of times, I mean, you know exactly what you're playing. And I really wish like they need to do like small things like, in the match roster, they really need to show like some sort of icon to tell you which people in the match list are your friends. So, because if I don't know somebody's handle, I don't know if I'm playing against friends of mine or not, even though I may have, unless I specifically went in and chose somebody to like join their matches, you have no idea.
That'll be a useful thing for them to implement when they add voice chat one day. I honestly think they could.
Again, I mean, this is another thing, because the matches are so short, I don't really miss voice chat. You can kind of get, and trust me, I am the biggest proponent of voice chat you could possibly find.
Yeah.
But the way that they've designed this game, the game is so chaotic that it's not necessarily reliant on voice chat.
Yeah, I agree with that, but where it would really make a difference is in the lobby. It's when you're waiting for the match to start. Yeah. Because there's nothing else you can do. I know they have that, you know, little mini game on the gamepad or whatever, but you can't change your gear. You can't change your appearance between matches. You know,
yeah,
you can't move around. You can't select your team. You can't even send text messages back and forth like you could in Mario Kart Wii.
Yeah.
And you definitely can't voice chat, which you can in Mario Kart 8 on the Wii U. So
yep.
That's where it's between the matches where there's like 2 minutes or more of downtime. And I know because James and I have played where we were just on Skype the whole time.
Yeah.
And that we weren't talking. We couldn't hold a conversation really while we were playing the game. But it's between
yep.
the matches where it makes a big difference. And it really kept us playing. That was by far the longest session I've had with Splatoon. So it makes a big difference to me.
All of my long play sessions, I've had somebody on Skype. But at the same time, I wouldn't want it to be an open channel.
No, just friends only.
Yeah.
That's the thing. There's enough of your friends playing it right now because it's a very popular game
mm-hmm.
that would work fine. You know,
yeah.
Yeah, it would be
friends
great.
Only voice chat. I mean, make it opt-in, whatever. But yeah.
Now, I don't know about changing gear in between matches. I don't know about that.
It may not be possible if they're factoring your gear into the matchmaking.
That's, well, I mean, my thought about it is that it might, it might change things so much. It might kind of allow you to see what the other team is.
Not if it doesn't display it to the other people. It could be a secret.
Yeah, you can still tell, though. I mean, you can still, you know what guns people are using in general. I mean, you can tell if someone's using a splatter shot versus a, you know, roller.
Not if they show Callie and Marie during that stuff instead of letting you look at other characters and what their loadout is.
Yeah.
There's easy ways to get around that, I think.
Yeah. I just thought the way the game is right now, I just felt that if you could constantly keep changing your gear, it would allow you to kind of change things competitively, you know? Like, it's just the way it is right now, it's kind of like it's sort of, the game is almost predicated on you keeping the same gear over and over again. But I will say, I have to describe this game. If I was to describe this game to somebody, I would say it is a casual shooter. I don't mean necessarily for casual gamers,
mm-hmm.
for babies. I'm not saying
it's a
baby game for babies. What I'm saying is, if you don't really care about devoting a whole lot of time to shooters and don't really want to worry about the best loadout or any of that kind of stuff, this is a great game for you if you kind of want that quick hit gameplay. Mm-hmm. Because this almost is something that, I mean, I could almost see this game concept being taken to, like, being played on a tablet or something like that.
I was going to say, it could be a portable game, like a 3DS yeah. or NX game.
Yeah, it's that kind of game. It's very much like very quick matches, simple, easy to grasp gameplay. You know, they layer on some stuff with, like, you know, with the guns, that, you know, the different guns and different, you know, gear and stuff. But even that isn't really taken too seriously. And I mean, I found right from the start, I didn't really find that I was getting stomped out, even though I'm playing characters that are, like, you know, level 17, level 19, level 20.
No, I mean, there will be the odd situation where you run into somebody who's just the Splatoon equivalent of a Terminator, and you just can't do anything, and that person just destroys everybody. But in general, you always feel like you're in the thick of it. Like, you especially when you're talking about that end game stuff where you can turn the whole match at the very end, because there's a built-in ability to come back quickly, because if you're way down, your paint is way more likely to have, you know, actual meaningful effect on the battlefield than your opponent's is, because you have more stuff left to paint.
Yep.
And you're essentially increasing your score by 2 relative to theirs, because you're taking away 1 and adding 1 to you.
Well, also, yep. if you look at it this way, if the other person's paint pattern is growing outwardly towards your base, if you're on the losing end of that and they're kind of dominating the map, that means that the place that you're spawning from and the place where the battlefront likely is, which is near your base that they're advancing upon, that's where you have the quickest, easiest access to the alternate colors paint that you can paint over, which mm-hmm. will affect a reversal of the tide of battle even more. So that's where it's very brilliantly set up, so that the more you're down, the more quickly you can get back up.
Yeah, the only match in which I really, really got completely waxed was one where I think we got beat 87.0% to 4.7%.
Oh, and they were God. Actually,
yeah, we just got, I mean,
that's the worst I've ever heard of, John.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't believe it. We just walked into a buzzsaw. In fact, they were killing us so bad, they were ink striking us at our spawn point. So you spawn, and ink strike lands literally right in front of you, like, where, like, the area where you're supposed to drop down. It was like in Moray Towers. So you spawn, and then you drop right down. They were ink striking us right there where we dropped down from the spawn point. And I was like, and it's one of those things that it was like slowly, it dawned on me. I was like, oh my God, the entire map was their color. And I was like, holy crap, we must be getting absolutely waxed. At the end of the game, it's like 87.0 to 4.7. I was like, holy crap.
Did they all have brackets in front of their names with some kind of clan name?
No, it was just, that's the thing. It just snuck up on me, because it wasn't like some kind of like clan or something like that. It was really weird.
That you know of.
Yeah, that I know of. I mean, we got completely waxed though.
I mean, I've been part of both the bodying and the getting bodied. It's weird, because you can be in the midst of bodying somebody and not realize it. I mean, we had one where, I think they were down. I think they had 9% at the end, and I thought it was way closer until the map came up at the end. And went, oh my God, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah, typically most matches are usually in like the kind of like 50% to 30 or 40 something to 40 something range usually.
Because it's so easy, like I said, it's so easy to start the comeback, even if you can't complete it, that even when you're getting bodied, you just have to get past your opponents and you can just start doing stuff back there.
Yeah, or you can just go where they aren't.
Right.
And they can't get back to you in time to stop you from covering territory.
Yeah, and that's sort of the perk about there being such a small number of people in the game, because it's really easy for one person to just wipe out the entire opponents and then let your team kind of have free run for a little while and regain some territory.
Now, I did play some of the campaign too, which is interesting. I mean, it was cool. It was some good, you know, platforming stuff in there. I haven't really played too deep in it, but I understand you have to get scrolls that lets you get some of the better guns.
You don't have to.
I'm through the third world, I think. I think I'm starting on the fourth, so I'm chipping away at it. And the campaign is interesting to me because I think some of the different things they have you doing is cool. Like I did one where there were moving platforms and like laser grids that I had to get through. And so what I had to do is, like, as soon as I got on the next platform, I had to paint it and then be able to, like, dip down into the ink as the platform moved through the laser grid so it wouldn't slice me up. And that was some, like, really clever stuff. But then there's also been parts of it where they make me do a lot of jumping, like, you know, to try to latch onto the side of a block that's hanging out over in space. And that stuff I get a little frustrated by because I don't think the jumping is that good in Splatoon.
Yeah, it's a bit slow.
Jumping is not something I ever want to do. I'll do it when I have to, but I'm not out there jumping around just like during the match because it doesn't feel good.
There are some opportunities to do essentially swim jumps that can really help out in matches, but unless you're really good, like really good at landing those every time, I would advise against doing it.
It's part of it is the timing of when, you know, how far can I go before I can clear the ledge?
Mm-hmm. That, yeah.
It feels a little bit off to me. I don't know.
Yeah. It was off to me just when you're doing the tutorial.
Yeah.
It was hard to me to hit. It was hard for me to hit that jump in the tutorial. I would always just miss it. It was just weird.
Yeah. It's like, it's subtle enough that I wonder if it's something I'll just get used to one day, but it's a little bit like kind of Little Big Planet. The jumping and how that feels. It's like, I could work with this, but it's not really, it doesn't really feel right to me. But it's, you know, the game generally isn't too dependent on the jumping stuff. Dan, have you played any Splatoon?
I haven't played a ton of it. I played it at Nintendo at the preview event for a few hours. And then I played it again one night just here, just streaming it kind of random. So I need to actually invest in like the story and all of that still, but I definitely like it. It's been fun. Going back to the kind of the voice chat point, I mean, that was a weird thing, like for me to try to even picture how that game was going to work in the wild, because at Nintendo, you know, you had everybody in the same room, so you know, it's like you start getting kills and then you hear people like cursing out the avatar and like that's my guy. So, you know, it's just like one of those, you know, that high energy of being in a room with everyone playing, and then without voice chat, you don't really have that.
Yeah, I think it's worked out. It's such a good game that I think it still works in spite of that, and some of the clever design and interface decisions they've made somewhat compensate for the lack of voice chat, but I still think it would improve the game quite a bit if they implement it in the right way. But, you know, that'll probably never happen. So I'm going to go next with new business, and I'm going to talk about a similar to John. This is kind of a game that I wasn't sure I would ever talk about here on the show, and I wasn't sure I'd ever play it, but I have been playing a few hours of Hyrule Warriors. Borrowed this from a friend. So it was a guilt-free, you know, kind of like, you know, hang on to it as long as you want. And so I've been kind of chipping away at it over the last week, and I've played a few of the, I'm basically doing the campaign. Like I don't think I'm going to get too much into the whole adventure mode and all that weird stuff, but I figured, well, I'll just play through the story. I don't know how long that's going to take. And I don't know if I'm going to make it that far because it's like, I don't love it. That's for sure. It's not bad, but it's like such a very low level of fun to me. Cause it's just kind of, it's like kind of tedious and kind of silly, and it feels very fluffy and inconsequential, and like there's a bunch of story stuff that I think is goofy and not very interesting. You got like the Queen of Cleavage is stealing the Triforce, and these, you know, a bunch of characters that I don't even know who they are kind of running around and yelling at each other, and Link is there for some reason, it's kind of like Subspace Emissary level of storytelling, in my opinion. But, you know, the action is, it is easy and engaging and very flashy. You know, it's not quite hypnotic, but there is kind of like a weird choreographed chaos on the screen, in just how many characters are running around all the time and how many weird, you know, visual effects your character is producing one after the other, after the other, after the other. You know, like even some of these characters, even their basic attacks look like wild magic things. And then you just start doing combos and the whole screen just starts flashing. It's very anime in that way. So it's eye candy, I suppose. Like, it's not the most beautiful game ever, but it's very candy-like in its appearance. And it controls fine, and it's fun to see like these giant versions of these classic bosses, I can't even remember the four-headed plant from the first Zelda, but it spits out bombs and gas.
Yeah.
But there's one of those, you know, and it's kind of running around, and that, I don't think that's one that they've ever really done in a 3D Zelda game. So it was kind of neat to see that. You know, it's fun to play as characters like Sheik and Impa, and I'm thinking about buying the Tingle DLC just because the game itself is costing me nothing.
That's how they get you.
And I'm really curious, and it sounds hilarious to me, and I think it's very much in the spirit of this game, which is, this is not a game you could ever say was like, you know, they were kind of tarnishing the tone of it by adding a playable Tingle. I mean, it's...
Now, why can't you just say, I'm going to buy it, and I don't care what anybody thinks about it? Next question.
Yeah, you know.
Just admit that you're Tingle curious. It's fine.
I almost bought it last night. I decided to wait because I wanted to get it at the same time as Blaster Master. But I kind of thought about not doing it because I saw that it's $8. And I thought, I don't mind kicking a few dollars to the people who made this since I didn't actually have to buy it. But I don't know if I want to pay $8 to see Tingle run around for 3 minutes before I get bored of it and walk away.
Yeah.
But I was reading up on it, and it's a Majora's Mask DLC pack. And it also includes Young Link, who I think it's probably when you use his magic power with the ZR button, when you use the green magic gauge. But he turns into Fierce Deity Link.
Hmm.
And that sounds pretty cool. I'd like to see that. That sounds like it'd be worth playing with for a few minutes. So maybe I'll chip in the $8 just to see how goofy it is so I can talk about it on the show.
Did you ever play the Tingle DS game?
No, I wanted to.
Oh.
We streamed that for a little while. I have it in the library. I need to actually like sit down and like spend some real time with it someday. It is such a bizarro, weird game.
Yeah.
It's like just full of like all of this innuendo and any just like even to get information out of anyone, you have to negotiate. And it's like, oh, you want me to tell you about that? Well, how much are you willing to pay me? But then your rupees are also like your life meter. It's just all this craziness.
Well, you never have any idea how much you have to pay them. Like, what's that minimum threshold to get over? So you can totally screw yourself by overpaying somebody. But you'll never know if you did.
Well, I can say briefly that I played some Drive Club.
Nice.
I know John wanted me to talk about it for some reason.
Yeah, I'm curious about this game. Well, I mean, it got such a bad rap, but I mean, I like driving games, so I'm just curious about it in general.
Yeah, I was one of the higher reviews on that, which thankfully has come around and worked out in my favor because the community's been loving it.
You know, I didn't pay for this. It was on PlayStation Plus. It's not a game I would normally be that interested in, but with all the hubbub over the PlayStation Plus version of it being delayed by like 6 months, or actually, I guess from the original announcement, it's been delayed for like way over a year from when they originally told us it would be ready. Because I think it was going to be a launch thing.
Yeah.
Originally, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, fun story about that. I got the hint on that really pretty early because before launch they had an event, preview event at Sony to go see their games, and it was like, guys, where's Drive Club? Why is that not here? And they wouldn't say anything about it at the time.
Security, remove this man.
Did you get the what's Drive Club? I've never heard of this game.
Well, you know, as it turns out, I would say, John, there's not that much to be curious about. I mean, you don't have Plus, do you, John?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, you do. Well, then you should download it. I mean, if you know, if if it appeals to you. I mean, it's very pretty. That's the main reason I downloaded it, is because I'd heard it was pretty and I kind of wanted to see it, and it is pretty. And I like that, you know, all the races that you do, you can control the weather and the time of day and stuff like that. And so I played around with it, and you know, I'm like, what does this city in China look like at 3 a.m. when it's raining? You know, and it, it's very pretty. The driving model doesn't feel that great to me. It's not the kinds of cars that I usually play as in driving games, and it's way more simulation like than what I get into.
How is it though? Is it floaty?
No, I don't think it's floaty. It just feels like you really have to slow down a lot to get around a turn without just smashing into the wall. It feels technical in a way, you know, whereas like in Mario Kart, you know, everybody's like, in 200cc, you really have to start to use the brake. Well, I mean, in Drive Club, you're not going to get around the first lap if you don't use, at least lay off the gas a whole lot and probably hit the brake. So, I mean, anyway, this is like real, you know, if you're into driving games, all this is like obvious and assumed, yeah. But I'm not into driving games. So I'm just checking this out because it is free to me, or it's part of PlayStation Plus. And, yeah, I got bored with it pretty fast because for one thing, it's like I think the cars that they start you out in are not very competitive, and you're supposed to just sort of lose a lot before you build up enough experience that you can unlock better cars. And those better cars are locked behind a paywall in the PS Plus version. So I'm unlocking cars as I play more of the game, but I can't actually use them. So then I just keep playing the game with the same crappy car that you start with, and it's slow, and all the other cars just kind of smoke it. Plus, I'm still learning the controls, and I'm not good at it. But I just kind of felt like I was doing the same courses over and over again, and it felt like all the opponent, you know, the AI, I don't even think this is really online. I think you're mostly just racing as the computer. That's what it felt like. And to me, it felt like all those cars were always like in a very tight bunch, and they were always like just a few car lengths ahead of me. Like I could never get up enough speed to catch up with them. And if I ever did, I couldn't make any advancement because they were packed in so densely. It's like even by the third lap of the race, the first 11 cars in the race are like bumper to bumper, you know, where it's like, I've never played a racing game where, you know, like I'm in 12th out of 12th place and my finishing time is less than 5 seconds of the first place guy. Like what the hell's, this is supposed to be the early part of the game. This is the sample that you gave to me to demo and you're trying to sell me on the rest of it. And it just feels like I'm never going to be good at this. Like this feels impossible to me. So I don't think it's that great.
Or you would buy a certain car and you would be so OP that it would swing back completely the other way and you'd be smoking everybody.
I guess, but it just turned me off. The feel of it and the way the races are kind of laid out, I just never felt like I was competitive. And so it's like, this isn't really that much fun. So yeah, it's definitely not for me. But the game I really wanted to talk about is Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I started this when I was staying with John back at E3 like a month ago. I think it was about a month ago. Feels like even longer than that. But yeah, I had just kind of barely opened it up and like started a save file, John, when I was at your place. I was doing like the, you know, like item gathering quest, I think.
Yep. Yeah, you're just going through the tutorial, really.
And so I didn't really have anything to say about it at that time, and you and I did not get to play it together, unfortunately, which was my hope originally. I just never had time to get far enough during E3. But I've since played it for several hours, and I've gone to the second village, and I've got an almost complete set of Great Jaggy armor.
Cool.
I am like 80% Jaggified.
Nice.
I have not been able to upgrade my insect glaive because there's a couple of ingredients to do that I have never seen, and I don't know where to get them. And I've thought about checking a guide, but I haven't had time. So,
yeah.
I'm still in the early part of the game, but I think I'm kind of dipping into the loop, the cycle, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm definitely to the point where I'm curious and I want to keep playing. I feel like the grind of just going through different armor sets by like killing the same monster 5 times, like I did with the Great Jaggy, is going to get pretty old to me. You know, yep. I think I'd like to see a lot of this content once. And I don't necessarily just want to grind through it multiple times just to, complete an armor set. And I feel like that's kind of what the game is set up for. You know, Destiny's the same way, and it's kind of where I lose interest with that stuff. It's like, I want to do all this stuff once, and then I want to do the next thing that I haven't already seen, like Super Mario Brothers. You know, I don't want to be playing the same shit over and over again.
Well, the thing is, with armor sets, right? I mean, with armor sets, I mean, the way I approach it is that if there's, you know, I kind of find out what the good armor sets are. I mean, there are some armor sets that are good. Like I went after the Tetsukabra one. So right now I have the whole Tetsukabra armor set, which looks frickin' sweet.
Now, do I have to buy the book at the store in order to hunt that thing?
Or is that no.
just I figured it was just like tips and tricks, but I don't know if you have to buy the guidebook from the merchant in order to even have the ability to fight that thing.
No, I think you just need to go through the quests. I'm not too sure what those guidebooks do, really. They probably give you some sort of, you know, extra bonus or something. But yeah, I mean, generally the way I approach armor sets is that I don't really get too hung up on it. I just try to go through the quests. And if there is an armor set that I really want, then I'll kind of stop. Well, because what you'll find is that you will eventually kind of max out with an armor set anyways. Like having a full armor set, you know, it'll give you some extra things, like maybe you can, you know, sharpen your sword more quickly or something like that, or you'll have extra defense or extra defense against fire or something like that. But eventually, you know, you should really just try to focus on always just upgrading your equipment as much as you can and not really worrying too much about armor sets, because armor sets eventually kind of max out. So you will be able to probably go farther with an armor set and beat better monsters that way. But eventually you'll get to a monster that will just, you just probably won't be able to beat it.
And that's when I'll quit forever.
Well, no, but but the thing is, that's when you ditch your armor set and you actually just start getting gear that you can afford at that point, right? So in other words, you will beat monsters, get new types of ingredients, and then you kind of go with a mismatched set for a while, but just kind of optimize for defense or whatever, you know?
Hey, why isn't send item to box the default option?
I don't know.
Because that's what you want to do 99% of the time.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
How about a button that sends everything to the box and I'll dig out the herbs later if I feel like I need to take them with me? Because you don't have to have stuff in your inventory to go craft. And that's the main reason that you want items in the game anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, and your bag really doesn't get that much larger either. Ugh. Down the line. So yeah, that's one of those things. I totally agree.
Some of these interface tweaks are so obvious. If you play the game even as little as I have, it's like, nah, I can think of about 10 different ways I would tweak this and make it a way better experience. But it's definitely a fun game. I mean, I've enjoyed kind of getting used to the controls. I think the environments are very beautiful and interesting in how many different little features there are, you know, like changes in elevation and the nooks and crannies, caves that additional monsters will spawn out of, shortcuts from one area to the next. I will say, and I've mentioned this to you before, John, if Monster Hunter ever comes back to console, I think they really need to try to make an open world version of it. Or at least, you know, these regions that you go to that have, you know, like 12 different little subsections that all connect to each other in this intricate way, those need to, you know, kind of like Pangea, become one continent that's just contiguous. You know, you need to be able to just roam freely without these little load screens. They're reasonably fast loading on the new 3DS. I think this is a game where having the faster processor in the new system, it makes a difference, because it is kind of like subdivided into a lot of little chunks and areas that have to load in. So being able to switch quickly from one to the next, it kind of makes it a smoother experience. But I think they need to go all the way and just make it a single area, a big large area that streams in as you run around it, more like Xenoblade, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that will really enhance the game. So
yeah, I certainly think that they could kind of have the best of both worlds, where they did have an open world but still kind of, you know, hem the action in. I think that's the reason. Yeah, I think the reason why they do that was, of course, when this series started, it was on the PS2, and technically they just couldn't do it any other way.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
But the game, the scale of the game still feels like a PS2 game. That's kind of what nags at me a little bit when I'm playing it.
Yeah, and you know, I think part of that is because they kind of want to keep the focus of you, Mono, a monster-o, in this little kind of confined area, and they probably want to just focus it on that battle, like kind of like the close quarters combat kind of thing. So they're probably not really looking at making it some huge expansive world, but I think they really could make it a bit better.
You know, once you have aggro on a monster, they could throw up like a faint colored ring on the ground that overlays, that shows you how far away you can go before, you know, before either you run into an invisible wall that's like dynamic and moves around with the monster, or that you run away from the monster and now it's chasing you, or that it leaves the circle or something like that and now you're chasing it, and you better hope you put a paintball to track it because it's fast and it'll just get far away from you. I mean, there's this, it's easy for me to imagine how that game would play, and you could still retain the things that people like about the series, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, having to actually track a monster through the woods into the next area, like just have it like one big sandbox, I mean, that would be really, really cool.
Yeah.
You know, and have the thing actually like running through the woods, knocking over trees and stuff. And I mean, it would just be crazy. You could do a lot of stuff with it.
That's the promise of that Horizon game that Guerrilla's making for PS4, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's, that interests me. Certainly.
I like the look of it anyway. I think that the style, you know, the weird like post-apocalyptic resurgent human civilization robo dinosaur thing just sounds awesome. It's intriguing. It's exciting. So I like the idea of, I want to see that big world and all the weird things that they fill it up with.
I know Scalebound, which hasn't really, they didn't show it at E3, but I know for Xbox One they have Scalebound, which that looked very Monster Hunter-ish to me. That's another one that hasn't really been shown very much lately.
Yeah, I feel like we don't even know what that game is yet. It's just, it's that CG thing, and hopefully, when they show it at Gamescom, it'll be in a, like, a really big way. Because I'm curious.
Will you be there, Dan?
I won't actually be there, no.
You've been a lot of times, though, haven't you?
Yeah, I want to say I've been there four, maybe five times. I don't remember exactly. I think four is probably safe, but I might have been, I have to count them all. But yeah, it's seeing something like that coming out of Platinum, I'm just really excited to see what they're going to be doing, just because you can tell us probably what they have their full weight behind. So.
Yeah, and I mean, my last thought on Monster Hunter, Johnny, is that we should play that. You should play that with other people.
Yeah, I think I'm finally to the point where I'm probably ready for that.
And I think, frankly, you'd have a lot more fun doing it that way.
Yeah. I definitely want to play with you, because I think you'll point out a lot of interesting things about it that I would not have gathered from the way the game explains itself, which is like, it explains itself in like a really like overwritten kind of like the help menu is like insanely deep and intricate, but it's hard to actually find things in it. You know, like it's kind of contextual, kind of not. It's still kind of a mysterious game, but you can tell that they've done a lot to make it better over the years.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times you're like, just give me the shorthand of what I need to do here. I don't want to dive through a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, well, people are probably thinking the same thing about this new business segment. But
true.
Yeah, we need to button it up here soon. But first, we got to hear about James and what he's been playing.
Yeah, so I was giving y'all some flack for playing all the hot bangers of 2015. And I actually went pretty far back myself with Trace Memory for the DS, which is only 10 years old, so it's fine. You would be forgiven for not remembering this game, because conceivably there are people who listen to this show who were like 7 or 8 when it came out. It's a near DS launch game that is essentially one of the kind of wave of these adventure games that we got in the early to mid DS life cycle. You know, I think part of it was the presentation of touchscreen allowed people to sort of play with old PC game concepts on the DS, and to a certain extent you can make these kind of, you know, hidden item / puzzle games fairly economically. And in fact, Nintendo was somewhat active in pursuing them. I think they co-published this in Japan with
Sing,
yeah, and I think in the West they may have actually published it themselves.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
But they did not in the West publish the Wii version.
Right, that never came out
correct.
Here.
Correct.
That was another Code R, I believe, was the Japanese title.
Yeah.
Yes. So basically you play this girl who is going to an island that has blood in the name, because sure, why not?
Blood Island.
To meet her father, whom she hasn't met since she was three, who she believed to be dead, and he's a total dick and makes her wander around this mansion solving puzzles to find her. That's basically the game. Oh, and she meets a ghost. I mean, that's what she's dealing with.
She's carrying a DS around with her, too.
Yes, sure. She's carrying a rebranded DS that is the high technical point of science and of understanding human memory. Also, it's an original DS, so it looks like garbage. It's one of those weird DS, like there's that weird GBA DS era where the character in the game would be holding a rebranded version of the console.
Yeah, Luigi's Mansion did that. Yeah. Conker did that even.
Yep. This is kind of this odd little meme that they slipped into a bunch of games, especially Nintendo developed games that I never entirely understood, but they did it. And in fact, in this game, you discover notes from your jackass of a father that he leaves in the form of DS carts that you put into the DS itself. It's stupidity, but
did you get to the part where you actually you fold the DS?
Oh God, no! Oh Lord! Okay, well, that's something to look forward to.
I might have spoiled that, but if it's not something that immediately stands out to you to do.
So yeah, basically it's kind of a not especially difficult puzzle adventure game. So you're looking for items in rooms. To unlock doors, to go to other rooms to find items, to unlock doors to the next rooms, etc., etc. And it's broken up into these chapters that I'm kind of clipping through it about half an hour a piece, so not too bad. To think of a more modern analog on the DS, it controls, you know, you move through the world and find stuff not dissimilar from, say, the Edgeworth game that came out on DS, and you solve puzzles closer to, you know, that highly well-known 999 on the DS. So really, I've just referenced two incredibly obscure games to explain another obscure game. So if you're following this, you've probably already played this game.
It's a point-and-click adventure. It's simple.
Yeah, it really is. There's some pretty decent puzzles in here so far. There was one where the keys didn't work on a door and you had to figure out what they were trying to make you do with the keys. That was pretty interesting. It's fairly simple. If you find that you get frustrated by point and click adventures, but sort of like the mechanics, this might be a one to go back in the time machine and tell yourself to play from 05. I'm actually a little bit embarrassed I never got around to this one. It's kind of a function of the DS just had so many of these adventure games, especially in, you know, 05 to 09. Where it was, I mean, if you liked these games, there was a lot of them. Like, I've still got, like, things like Lost in Blue to get through at some point.
Yeah, it was hard to keep up with 3DS, period, back in those days.
Or DS,
The DS, yeah. But, I mean, it was part of the reason that we've often pined for some way to go back and, you know, buy these on the 3DS and just download them. Because there's so many really interesting games from that era that even, you know, running a Nintendo website at the time, I didn't get to play all of them because there were just too many to keep up with back when the DS was really in its prime. And all those fantastic Japanese games started to come over, especially in 2005, 2006 era, which is what you're talking about, you know, right before and during the early days of this podcast, actually, nine and 10 years ago.
And then it was, like, really easy to import all that stuff, too, unlike now.
It was. Yeah. It was cheap. It was, for the first time, we had affordable shipping from Japan, and the DS was, you know, region-free, and you had the rise of all the fan sites and stuff like that on the internet, so you had much better information available to just average people that these games were available and that they were affordable and that they were relatively easy to play. It was the first time I ever imported stuff, was right back in that era.
And even if you weren't interested in importing, we were getting, you know, the good, solid majority of the games that had any real market whatsoever in the U.S. Like, they weren't holding stuff back in Japan. They were, but it was shit that,
not
like...
Not very much, you know.
That you would sit there and go, wait.
I mean, when you have Feel the Magic, XXYXY...
No, you have the sequel to Feel the Magic.
Yeah, even that came over, the Rub Rabbits. Yeah. That stuff is remarkably Japanese. So, I mean, it's so weird for it to come out here at all. And,
yeah,
you know,
but it did.
Feel the Magic was like a big seller even, so weird stuff back then.
Hot DS launch library.
Pink Pals, baby.
Oh my God.
Oh, wow.
Like, that was a game. Like, that was a literal, that was a retail release.
I mean, no, John, it wasn't a game, but it did come out, yes.
It's true, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if you miss this one, you can get it for $5. I mean, I bought it for next to nothing.
Yeah, for now, give it a couple more years and DS games will be retro and they'll be very expensive. But for now, you can get stuff like Trace Memory pretty cheap.
Yeah, and you know, I'm having fun with it. So, yeah, I mean, if you like this kind of game, if you liked any of those games I mentioned, if you liked Lost in Blue, which is kind of a similar game in a lot of ways, you know, if you liked, even if you like Ace Attorney games, you know, they're not quite adventure games.
Ghost Trick is much more point and clicky than Phoenix Wright.
Ghost Trick is much more about the environmental puzzles too.
Yeah.
Like, but
Hotel Dusk was by them too, right?
Yep. Oh yeah, that's the one.
Give this one a shot. It seems to be a well made game of the genre, and you know, there's not a lot of those now in the handheld space like there were, you know, 10 years ago. They kind of moved into the indie PC space, you know, kickstarted kind of stuff. But you know, I had fun with it, or I'm having fun with it. I intend to finish it. So
nice. Well, let's finish up this first segment. It's gone pretty long here, but we had a ton of stuff to talk about. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got your listener mail in the Thunder Round.
It's now playing. A sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a preview of Devil's Third on Wii U by Don Koopman.
You all right, James?
I feel like I'm going to throw up already.
Yeah, I know.
Like a moth to a flame, the Kusuge finds its way to Don, and Itagaki's newest is no exception. He takes the European police of this trashterpiece for a ride and gives you the war-weary impressions of a man that's seen too many terrible games. War never changes, neither does Kusuge. Yeah. Got it. Sick.
Yeah, I mean, just pull through it. Just, you know.
I feel like Itagaki's will was punching me in the stomach.
Yeah. Well, his game is going to be released whether you like it or not, James. So
I don't.
He can't be stopped.
Also this week, we have a preview of Little Battler Experience on 3DS by Neil Ronahan. Neil and Justin had a chance to get a hands-on with Level 5's new mini robot battle game. Neil provides a blow-by-blow summary of the epic battle, giving you a little bit of insight into the grimdark, hyper-competitive, high-stakes world of LBX.
Yeah, it's called LBX in the streets. That's what the warring gangs that call it.
I mean, I lost some friends to LBX, so I...
Yeah, me too, man. I mean, it's tough all around.
Government's got to get on top of this.
Yeah, I mean, preview of Animal Crossing Happy Home Designer for 3DS by Justin Marume. When is a game more than a game? When it fulfills one bald man's lifelong dream of designing homes in Animal Crossing. Justin plays My Dream as he tells us what he thinks of this strange new entry in the Animal Crossing series. Bring on the amiibo cards. Wish fulfilled.
This is really going to go into John Lennon amiibo reviews in a real dark place.
That's the thing. This looks like a virtual fountain of possibilities for amiibo.
No, it's a literal fountain of possibilities for amiibo.
All right, and we got a feature, Pokemon Symphonic Evolutions, a look at the LA show by Kim Keller. Kim takes us along to check out the recent Pokemon Symphony show at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, Becky is not happy as she sits at home and does not partake. Do they reconcile? What does epic live Pokemon music sound like? Read this and find out.
All this and more friendship-shattering discussion of video game music is available to you right now at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome back, everybody. It is time for the Thunder Round of Listener Mail. And as always, the address is rfn@NintendoWorldReport.com. Thunder Round. Dan Bloodworth, please read the first email.
All right. Eric writes, how's that new 3DS working out for you guys? Totally worth it for all those exclusive games and features, right? I'm glad I didn't fall for the DSi, too.
Yeah, you should be. It's a nice piece of hardware, but so far, they have absolutely not made it worthwhile. They have definitely not made it worth the $100, $120 that I spent to upgrade. from my previous 3DS XL. So yeah, I think so far if you've skipped it so far, I think you're right to do so. If you have one, you're probably reasonably happy with it, but you wish there was a lot more going on with the new 3DS. And you know, if you're waiting, I think that's the right thing to do. I think you should let Nintendo prove it to you that it's worthwhile, because so far I don't really think they've done it.
Yep, it feels like they forgot about it.
Yeah, it does.
I have the old brick 3DS, and I've had no reason to upgrade.
Yeah, it's pretty frustrating. You know, I like it. It's a good piece of hardware. I've used the C-Stick on certain things, and it works. It's not amazing, but it suffices, and it adds a kind of a different twist to a couple of things. But it's just not... It's such a subtle change from what came before, and it feels like a lot of untapped potential right now. And I don't know if Nintendo's really that interested in tapping that potential.
Before I call out the next question, I like when we just start right off the bat with our users taking shots at us. That's good.
Well, there's more of that to come, I think.
Good.
Yeah. So John has the next email.
All right, Alex writes, does the Virtual Console version of Ocarina of Time make the 3D version irrelevant from a price perspective? Which way do you guys feel is the optimal way to play this game? Moving forward, how do you feel Nintendo will handle these remakes and emulations?
They're different games. I mean, they're the same core game, but I mean, that remake is pretty comprehensive. There's a lot of stuff in there that gets straightened out. Visually, it's quite different. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's more expensive. It's also on a different platform, so...
It's portable versus, you know...
Pick which version of the game you want to play at the price point you feel comfortable paying for it, and do what you do.
Yeah, I will say one thing, because I think I got through maybe a quarter or a third of the 3DS version. It was just one of those things where I feel like exploring a big world like that on a small screen, it just makes me feel tired after a while.
Tired.
I know what you mean. It's something that I think Majora's Mask does a little bit better, because it's centered more around smaller spaces. But you know, when you do get in the big dungeons, and you're kind of sometimes getting around, like, you know, like that central tower in the in Snowkeep or whatever it's called, mm-hmm. and some of the really big rooms in the Stone Temple at the end, it is exhausting. Is like a weirdly accurate description of it. It's a strange feeling, but yeah, it feels a little bit wrong to be looking around this big, complicated 3D space on such a small screen.
Well, he's got smaller legs, so it takes him more steps to cover the same distance.
Yeah, makes Majora feel bigger, right?
I gotta say, you gotta go with the gold cart red blood version. That's the one to go back to.
Red blood version. Wow. Did they change the color of the blood?
Oh, yeah, almost, second or third iteration of those cartridges?
Weird. I did not know that. I mean, mine's original. I had it at launch. I actually found my original cartridge from my parents' attic recently. Brought back a lot of memories of playing it back in the dorms. I was a wee young 18 years old playing
it. Thunder Round is not ground for reminiscing.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. When we talk about Ocarina and Majora,
Thunder Round is not round for
it. Is, I'm sorry,
explaining,
you're right.
Your reminiscing.
It's the Thunder Round. All right, I'll go next. Darth Cadus writes, now that Shovel Knight is getting a physical boxed retail release, would you like to see an amiibo figure of the titular hero, John Lindemann?
You know, but see, it's normally I would say no, but this time I would say maybe, because I really like Shovel Knight.
God damn it. I thought you were supposed to be the purist. You're just you're.
I am a purist, but so I do have my weaknesses. I'm not saying that I'll buy it. I'm not. That's for other people.
But you'd like to look at it. You would want it to exist.
Yes. Yes. I would have no
objections. I'd also like it to be in Smash Brothers.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems possible one day.
Yeah.
I'm a pass.
James,
I'm not in the position to desire the existence of any additional amiibo at present.
Yeah,
I would like them to be able.
It's a conflict of interest for you because you're in the process of purchasing all of them.
I would like them to exist at the point where people could buy them when they want them first, and then we can start deciding about adding third-party, independently developed, independently published characters to the amiibo lineup.
Yoshi's gonna cause bloodshed.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's gonna be America's newest blood sport.
Maybe that's how you get the red Yoshi.
Jeremy writes.
It's weak. So sad.
My question is whether the RFN cast foresees a point at which the Fire Emblem franchise makes a return to home consoles. Awakening and If/Fates have reinvigorated the franchise by moving it back to handhelds. What does this portend for the future of Fire Emblem?
Staying on handhelds for a long time.
I mean,
so yeah. Is Animal Crossing. Get used to it.
We got Sharp FE. What are you talking about? That's a Fire Emblem game, right?
I mean,
it's part of the reason that game sold well isn't just that it was on handhelds. I mean, they did some fairly radical design changes, even if the core gameplay mechanics are mostly the same. And I think that opened up the appeal of the franchise in a significant way.
Yeah, it's the best Fire Emblem.
So, I mean...
So that helps.
There may one day be another console Fire Emblem game. I mean, there is certainly grounds for them to do it, but it wouldn't be on a Wii U right now. There's no market potential for them to make that a very expensive game.
I just think what would it add for it to be on the Wii U?
I mean, it wouldn't be on their Wii.
Their aspirations for that franchise are kind of where they're already at. The 3DS hardware is powerful enough to make that game look like they want it to look. I've seen the GameCube and the Wii games, and they look, I would say, probably in some ways worse than the 3DS games. So I feel like this is probably the right level of graphical fidelity for that series, and the fact that it's portable is a perfect fit for its audience, and I think it's the kind of game people play on a portable. Animal Crossing, Japan is part of it. Japan.
But they may decide one day they won't. I'm not going to say explicitly this game will never happen because there is precedent for them to do this. This is a game that they may decide one day, hey, we have a console that's got a good enough install base and we want to do something that we think this makes more sense in the console space. And you know, we don't know what NX is. And, you know, some of the theories that have been kicked around, maybe it becomes consolable simply by merit of existence. And we don't know.
I'll say it's sticky. I can tell you on two different grounds why this game's the series is going to stay on handhelds. Number one, in Japan, handhelds are where it's at. That could turn around one day. We'll see. But for right now and for the foreseeable future, consoles are a joke in Japan, and handhelds are where it's at. And it's a very Japanese game. It's popular in Japan, and it always has been. On the other hand, Fire Emblem, although it started on Famicom, it's been around. There's a bunch of Super Nintendo games. It's been around for a long time. In the West, Fire Emblem debuted on the GBA. And so in the West, where there is also a growing and sizable Fire Emblem audience, that most of us associate Fire Emblem with handheld games because there have been so many of them, and they've generally been, I would say, as good or better than the console ones, which are fairly obscure and hard to find and very expensive.
I would argue that the best Fire Emblem game prior to the release of Awakening that came out in the West was the GameCube game. I feel like that game handles its strategy the best.
Okay. Fair enough. You've played a lot more of it than I have.
I've played all of it.
Yeah, that's a lot more. But I just think people generally associate Fire Emblem as a handheld franchise, both in America and now in Japan. And so I think it makes just too much sense. And I think Animal Crossing is much the same way. Not quite as much, but I think those games are probably going to take a break from consoles. I mean, we may see. Nintendo itself may take a break from consoles here with the NX.
Too much for a thunder round. All right.
Daniel, could you please read the next email?
Sure. Clex Yoshi writes, so I got bored and went through some of the Discover Music Project's older episodes, insert your crosstalk plugs here, and stumbled upon the show TYP and Dr. Metz did on Hirokazu Tanaka and his various contributions to music as a whole. If you guys could each co-host an episode of Discover Music Project and did an episode on a particular video game composer, who would it be? Why? What particular beats would you hit from their career? What musical pieces would you choose to play for the show?
This is
something that could actually happen, by the way.
Why did we thunder around this question?
Yeah.
Because you can throw out your answer real quick, and then we'll move on. James, yours is obvious.
Is it?
Yeah.
How so?
Shimomura.
Yeah, but I mean, Shimomura is tricky because it's probably been done. I mean, I'm not really blazing.
Not on my podcast, it hasn't. It hasn't been done with you.
Shibamura is amazing, and Shibamura has an incredibly broad list of things you could pull from, all the way to, you know, some of her most well-known pieces, like stuff from Street Fighter II, all the way to stuff from games that have never come out here because they're too freaking Japanese to ever potentially release in a market that isn't Japan. I mean, there's a wide stretch of stuff here that you could hit, yes.
Plenty of her stuff on Super Smash Brothers.
Yeah, oh yeah, all over.
Pretty much all of those soundtracks, I think, at least going back to Melee. John, any composers that you stick with?
Two come to mind. Uematsu certainly did all the Final Fantasy music. The one that I actually had to look up, but love the music, Hiroshi Kawaguchi, who did the music for Space Harrier and a lot of those old-school Sega arcade games. And I absolutely love the music from those games. So, Kawaguchi.
Dan, you are a man with an intense interest in video game music.
Yeah. I haven't been able to do my show for a while. I'm waiting for a proper moment to bring it back. I'd actually be curious. I don't know the composer off the top of my head, or I think it may be like a kind of a more collaborative thing. But I'd be curious to get into The World Ends With You and that soundtrack. It was very different, yeah. And just, you know, the kind of funky style to it.
Yeah, that's a good pick. I'll say, you know, Hip Tanaka was 2IP's idea mostly. I knew that he was a big fan, and so I kind of threw out the idea of doing video game music on my generally not video game music podcast. Mm. And he liked it, and I thought it turned out great. And we'll have a link to it in the show notes, hopefully, if I can remember. And I would love for people to check it out. I think you'll really like it. And, of course, there's a lot of great music in there from, you know, Earthbound and Metroid and Balloon Fight and a bunch of other stuff. So it's definitely worth checking out. Especially this week, because he worked on a lot of games with Mr. Iwata. But if I could choose my own, and maybe one day I will, I would probably do Koji Kondo, which is, you know, maybe like a really obvious pick. But for me, Discover Music Project is partly about bringing music that I love out to other people who might not normally hear it. And there's a lot of non-video game fans who listen to that show. And I would love to, you know, introduce them to the further works and the deeper catalog of a guy whose music every single person on the planet has heard. You know, and we can start with some version of Super Mario Brothers, but then go far afield of that. And, you know, for me, he's my favorite composer, I think, because he kind of introduced me to jazz along with maybe Mr. Rogers and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And so I love the way he infused and really introduced jazz into electronic synthesized music with video games. I think it's really interesting. So that's probably where I would go.
I might need to change mine to Yasunori Mitsuda, but that's fine.
Mitsuda is a rock solid choice, obviously. So yeah, maybe one day some of these episodes will get made. I would love to do that. And Dan, what's the name of your music show so people can go find that?
Yeah, it'd be really tricky. Sometimes older videos on the site are kind of hard to get to work, but it's called Backtrack. And if you just kind of Google Game Trailers Backtrack, you can find the episodes that way probably. I did actually do a pretty in-depth episode on Chrono Cross a few years back.
That's worth the treatment. That soundtrack is crazy and pretty amazing stuff. So, all right, well, let's move on to the next email, which John is going to read.
All right. Hey, Einstein writes, I just saw the video announcing Pokemon Shuffle for iOS and Android devices, which I find hardly surprising. I just wanted to ask what your guys' opinion of the game is now. It sounded like James was starting to get into it last time you mentioned it on the podcast. I think it's a decent puzzle game, and I don't regret the time that I've spent on it. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I played it.
I do regret the time I've spent on it.
Yeah, I think that's the thing.
I regretted it while I was addicted to it.
Yeah. And the nasty part about that game is the closer you get to its completion, A, the more insidious it becomes, and just borderline impossible, and B, they keep adding shit. So there's no end. And you realize that the stuff you just beat was almost impossible, and then they went and added stuff that's harder. You think to yourself, no. I can't do this anymore. I have to stop.
I have not played. It sounds like I probably shouldn't.
You should absolutely play.
I should, but I shouldn't.
I want to see you break down over a match 3 Pokemon game.
I think I'm going to pass on Pokemon Shuffle. I think I know pretty much what it is, and I'm sure I would play too much of it if I installed it, and then I would be in Dan's shoes later where I'd say, man, there are better things to do on the toilet than play a match three game. So I think I'll just skip it entirely.
That's why toilets were invented.
All right. So I probably shouldn't read this one because I kind of have to respond to it. So James, will you read the next email, please?
In response to my criticism of Federation Force petition, let me rephrase that. In response to Johnny's criticism of the Federation Force petition, someone wrote, I took some offense to how you addressed the people who signed the petition. I personally did sign the petition, and while I agree that it could have been worded much better, I believe the main point behind it was to send a message to Nintendo that they are really far off base with this game. Nintendo has for a while now come off like they have their fingers in their ears, and I think that the roughly 22,000 people who signed this don't want the game canceled as much as they just want to make an example out of it because it's such a good example to point to.
Yeah, I want to answer this question, but first off, really quick, I want to put out there that there's more to this email, and I went back and forth with this person who wrote in. And we really, I think, came to understand each other really well. And he actually ended up removing his name from the petition, which I had recommended. I wasn't sure if it's possible, but it is. And so if anybody else signed it and has kind of had second thoughts about it, it's good to know that you can go and take your name off of it. And so first off, this person called me out for using certain language in the way I kind of hypothesized or I sort of compared signing this petition, or rather I compared what the petition is saying to sort of telling the developers to go off and kind of do something, which I'm not going to repeat because it's just it's unfortunate that I said it, and I felt bad about it right away, and I kind of thought about apologizing and ended up just kind of moving on with the show. But I just want to say I wish I hadn't said that. It's not relevant to the point that I was making, so I apologize. And also I want to say I stand behind the gist of what I was saying about the petition, which is that I think it's a bad idea. I think, you know, if you think about it for a few minutes, I think you'll probably realize that it's not helpful and that it's not really something you should put your name on. And generally, I think petitions, most petitions, especially online petitions, which I've been crusading against for about 15 years now, are a bad idea. For a lot of reasons, they're generally not effective, and they can kind of associate you with a lot of people who you might actually very much disagree with, even on the subject of the petition. And part of it is that there's an intrinsic problem with petitions, which is that it is a specifically worded statement that you are putting your name to. And you can't just go back later and say, well, I agreed with part of it, or I interpreted it to mean this one thing that's actually different from what it actually said. You can't sign part of a petition. You put your name on it and you're saying, I agree with all of this, even if you don't. And that's what I think happens in a lot of cases. And the person who wrote this kind of said, well, you know, I signed it, and I think most people sign it, was to, quote, send a message to Nintendo that they are really far off base. That's not what the petition says. The petition says, you should cancel this game. It is an atrocity. And if those aren't the words that you would use, then don't use those words by putting your name behind them. Use your own words. Write your own letter. You know, send some kind of individualized response that's, I hope, respectful and thoughtful. And you can be constructive in your criticism. And I thought this petition was not. But that's all I'm going to say about it. If you guys want to continue discussing the petition,
couple points of order. To the fact that you felt the need to apologize, I feel like it really helps if you don't have a conscience and you just say whatever you think at that particular moment. So, for example, like, John, I signed the petition in your name. I just thought you should know that. I felt like it really encapsulated the flying off the handle irrational thought processes that I really think, yeah, it's John Lindemann.
That's the Jones doctrine.
Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about, James. especially in regards to this game. I have no idea what you're talking about.
I've got
this game
in
particular. I have no ill will towards it. I would like 10 of these games to be made for the
I wish I could just get a recording of you immediately after the E3 presentation and just release it on this feed, because it's fucking amazing.
I was going to say, John, you've really come around a long way
since
E3.
It's magic. It's magic.
Hey, you know? I've mellowed out in my old age, you know?
In it's the like intervening
now I can't sustain that rage for more than like a few hours at a time. I just get really tired, and I just need some warm milk, and I have to go to bed. You know? I can't do that. I can't do that stuff anymore. I can't hate for months at a time like I used to in my 20s, man. I can't do it.
It's a good feeling. It's a good feeling to just hate for years at a time. I mean, it really
Dan,
is.
Where's your outrage level on Federation Force?
Yeah.
You're a DEFCON X.
I'm not a fan of it, but I think, you know, as I think a lot of people have said, it's not so much that this game exists, it's it exists in a vacuum.
Right. I totally agree.
And it's this isn't the game we're asking for. Where's the game we're asking for? You want to screw around with these other soldiers later, then go for it.
But. Yeah, I feel like it's Christmas and you asked your parents for like a Game Boy Advance and they gave you like an N-Gage. And you can't
a
dick.
Whoa,
you know
what? Stop. That's worse. John, comparing a game to an N-Gage is worse than calling for it to be canceled. Like you've really fucking gone somewhere now. Like you could have at least gone like Neo Geo Pocket Color. Like given them a system that was respectably designed by engineers who aren't possibly mentally incapacitated.
Okay. Neo Geo Wonder Swan. I don't know. Whatever.
Oh, fuck you.
Maybe not Wonder Swan.
Great.
Maybe,
you can play Final Fantasy III
analogy.
In freaking Federation
Force. Okay, so they got you an Atari Lynx. I don't know. Whatever.
Someone in Next Level Games is going to hunt you down.
I know. I'm not making any friends over there.
I didn't even catch that. The Next Level was working on. That's funny.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, those guys didn't watch 12 hours of Treehouse Live every day during E3?
No. I wish.
Why don't you know all these details about all of Nintendo's games?
This is their project.
That's cool. I definitely believe in their work. So
exactly. Yeah.
I think this will be a good game. It's just I feel like it got thrown kind of under the bus.
I think the Atari Lynx of video games will be a good game, John Lindemann.
I do. I think it's one of the worst
TigerGame.com
of
video games
in a long time. I think. Yeah. I think in terms of just showing a game for the first time and like. Showing why it's cool. It's rare that I've seen a game fall so flat on its face, and largely because there was so little information about it, and it was so it almost reminds me of Wind Waker the first time that was shown. It's like there was no context. There's mm-hmm. this crazy video that leaks out of Japan, and everybody looks at it and says, "What the fuck are they doing with my favorite franchise?" You know, yep. That's kind of the feeling I have. It's like if Nintendo would just kind of open up a little bit and talk to us about it and show more of it and let a few people at least try it and like spread the word, I feel like that would go a long way. And they could do that probably today.
Mm-hmm. I would guess the reason that game wasn't on the floor in any play but the Blast Ball is that game is not ready to be played publicly.
Okay, then cut a trailer.
They did.
Cut a better trailer with people talking over it.
Yeah.
But cut a trailer. Done.
I mean, it's weird in a way because I think it's kind of a casualty of the whole, you know, let's blow everything out at E3.
Yeah.
If that hadn't been like shoved in with the rest of these E3 announcements, if they had taken the time apart from E3 before E3 to like get people accustomed to what this is.
Or if they'd used one of these live stream developer roundtable events that they've had for years and years and years and which they completely cut off this year. You know?
Yeah.
That would be just like with Codename Steam last year. It's like, look, we're doing something new. It's not easy to understand in a 30-second gameplay trailer. So we're going to sit down with you. We're going to show you. We're going to walk you through it. We'll tell you a lot about it. We give you access to two or three people that worked on it. You can sling questions at them, report all of this, put it on the web. Videos on YouTube, everybody can watch it. It's a good way to go in depth with a brand new game and sort of explain a foreign concept to the audience. And
I mean, I don't look at this game and think it's a particularly foreign concept. I mean, there's nothing jumps out at me this game. I don't understand how that plays at all. I mean, it appears to be a squad-based shooter set in the Metroid universe where you play as Federation soldiers.
As a Metroid fan, it feels extremely alien to me.
Yeah, and it's a Dream Crusher game because they decided to announce this game at the one event during the year where people are expecting a huge announcement like Metroid Prime to be made. You know, like they sent this thing out to be slaughtered, effectively.
The only way they acted like they didn't, which made
it even more annoying.
The only reason you'd have expected Metroid Prime to be this is if you did not believe they were telling you the truth and they said they weren't going to be talking about games that are more than a year or so out.
You know. I, you know,
John.
Thunder round. Thanks everyone for listening.
Are we going to end another podcast on Metroid Prime Federation Force? Are we really going to
do that?
No, because
we still got Dan's plugs.
Thank God.
So,
yeah.
So
let's turn this back up.
Thanks everyone who wrote in this week and the past few weeks, and we'll keep doing more Thunder Round. I like it. It's a fun way to do it. So anyway, the address as always is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And that wraps up this episode, but before we go, Dan, I would love to hear about where people can find you and watch your stuff and listen to your stuff and check out what you're doing over at Game Trailers.
Yeah, so we have the main website, which is gametrailers.com, which, you know, as everyone knows, is kind of due for an overhaul, and hopefully that'll happen in the next couple of months. But we also are putting all our stuff on YouTube now. So we have the youtube.com/gametrailers and /GTReviews. And we have our Twitch channel where we stream every weeknight, which is just twitch.tv/gametrailers. You already plugged Backtrack earlier, which definitely a passion project of mine that's long needed new episodes, but I'm not sure when that will happen. But next week I'll have my review for Tembo the Badass Elephant going up, so look forward to that.
Nice.
From Game Freak.
Yeah.
Not coming to Wii U for some reason.
Right.
Something about, I don't know. Weird. That's a weird situation.
I may never know the story of, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know. But
somebody might dig into that.
Yeah, maybe Unseen 64 will get to the bottom of it one day. So definitely go check out Dan's stuff. I guess you're officially now a YouTuber.
I guess.
I was kind of joking with Neil and the gang at E3. I was like, so are we YouTubers now? And he's like, well, partly, sort of, yeah. I'm like, okay, I can live with it. Anyway, definitely go check out Dan and Brandon and everybody else over at GameTrailers.com. And Dan, thank you again for helping to set up that thing at E3 for Neil and me to come and be on your show. It was really fun, and it was very exciting for us. We had a great time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sorry I missed most of it.
Yeah, you stepped
in
at the end.
My last appointment went very long.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was a lot of fun. We were on there for about 90 minutes, and we had a great time. So I'd love to do it again one day. But I'm also very thankful that we could finally get you back on the show. So thanks again, Dan. And hopefully it won't be another 7 or 8 years before you can come on RFN and tell us about more of the crazy games that you play all the time.
Sure, man. Absolutely.
All right, guys, that is the end of the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Arabica.
I promise we won't talk about Federation Force next week.
I will.